welcome to the Early Years Web Summit with me, Kathy Brodie of kathybrodie.com. On this summit, we're focusing on children's personal, social and emotional development. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Sally Goddard-Blythe, a well-known name everywhere. Sally is the director of the Institute for Neurophysiological Psychology, INPP, International, where she's worked since 1988. She's the author of many, many books about the INPP method and child development, and they include Reflexes, Learning and Behaviour, The Well-Balanced Child, What Babies and Children Need, Attention, Balance and Coordination, The ABC of Learning Success, which is my personal favourite, is really good, Assessing Neuromotor Readiness for Learning and Neuromotor Immaturity in Children and Adults. Welcome to the Early Years Web Summit, Sally Goddard-Blythe.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I can't wait to hear everything that you've got to say about INPP. But today we're going to be focusing on how understanding children's physical development underpins all their other development, and specifically how the INPP method can help children. So first of all, could you just explain a little bit about the basis for the Institute of Neurophysiological Psychology methods, please, Sally?
Well, this started out really in the 1970s as a quest to discover whether children who are presenting with symptoms of underachievement, such as reading, writing, spelling problems, and so on, had underlying physical factors or problems that were contributing to the presenting difficulty. So rather than just sort of looking at the surface of why is a child not reading, writing, and spelling, shall we teach more of the same? Trying to find out if the mechanics were there to enable a child to be successful. So at that time, Peter Blythe, who started INPP, was a lecturer in applied education, senior lecturer in applied education at a college in Lancashire. And he and one of his mature students decided to go into schools and carry out several tests to see whether there were physical problems. So they looked at things like patterns of motor development, laterality, which in those days was considered to be very important, eye movements and so on. And they found that the children who were not necessarily diagnosed actually as having problems, but who were underachieving, all had a profile where their physical abilities were less well developed than the children who were achieving at or above expected levels. So that was the sort of origin of it, which then led them into trying to develop methods, reliable methods of assessing those physical factors. And then perhaps more importantly, was it possible to put together physical movement programs that would put some of those problems right? Mm-hmm. So really in a nutshell, that's pretty much what the INPP method still is today. And that's where it came from. But what I should probably add is that the assessment tools that are used have been taken directly from mainstream medicine. So if they were carried out by a physiotherapist, occupational therapist, pediatrician, they should come up with the same results that we do, so that there is a degree of inter-test reliability in the methods of assessment that are being used.
And obviously very much based in that evidence, and this is something that has been proven, isn't it?
Yes, we have tried very hard, although we are not within the sort of medical modality, to make what we do acceptable in terms of the tools that we and methods that we use.
And this is international as well. We're not just talking about England or even the UK. This is around the world now, isn't it?
I think it was 14 plus countries last time I counted.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. So that shows that it actually works for all sorts of children. It's not just a particular context or a particular group of children. This is actually something that's going to work across the board for most children, isn't it?
Yes, that it's not socially or culturally dependent, that it is to do with children's biological development rather than where they happen to have grown up.
Yeah, which obviously gives it a lot more weight as well. Now, you've written a lot, but as I say, I'd like to focus a little bit on attention, balance and coordination, the ABC of learning success. In this book, you explain how early reflexes affect learning and behaviour. Can you explain a little bit about what an early reflex is and then how that goes on to affect learning and behaviour, please?
Okay, it might take some time. There are two main groups of reflexes that develop in a child's early life. The first one is are called primitive reflexes. And these are reflexes which start to emerge during life in the womb, should be fully present in a baby born at full term, so 40 weeks gestation, and are active from birth, but are then gradually inhibited or put to sleep by higher centers in the brain as connections to higher centers in the brain develop in the first 6 months of life, which they do very rapidly.
Right. Yeah.
And at the same time as those early reflexes are being inhibited or integrated, they are gradually either replaced or transformed into a group of postural reactions, which give a child, in a general sense, control of balance, coordination, and so on in a
Yeah.
gravity-based environment at a subconscious level. So you don't have to think too much about how do you sit, how do you stand, how do you walk. The executive part of the brain says, this is what I want to do, and the lower centers will do that at a subconscious level. So we will all probably recognize some of these little reflexes. If you stroke down the side of a newborn baby's face here, the head will turn and the mouth will open,
Yeah.
searching or rooting for the breast or the bottle. If you place something in the palm of the hands, the thumb will come underneath and the fingers will grasp and the baby won't let go.
Yeah.
And as supremely egotistical adults, we say, isn't that sweet? Baby wants to hang on to us. The baby actually has very little choice at this time. Now, those little reflexes should become modified so that when something is placed either in the palm of the hand or between the thumb and the forefinger at a later age, the thumb no longer wants to come underneath and the other fingers to curl on top. And the inhibition of that reflex means that a child can then form a good pincer grip and
Yeah.
then have good control of a writing instrument.
Yeah.
But if traces of that reflex are still present, as that child tries to place something between the thumb and forefinger, this is what the hand would like to do, and it makes it very difficult to form the correct writing grip, which then potentially can have an impact on a child's fine motor coordination skills later on. So there's a lot in the press at the moment about pressure on five-year-olds being made to write and perhaps too many tests and so on. That's another issue, but it does tie in with the whole issue of a child's physical readiness for the demands of the classroom that it's going to be placed in. If a child doesn't have those physical skills in place, whatever the age, then they are going to start to fail and underachieve, not because they don't have the intelligence to do so, but because they can't control the mechanics involved in the tasks that support academic learning.
Yeah, and that's actually a biological reflex, isn't it? They're not being naughty or not trying. That's tied into their biology, isn't it?
Yes, or their developmental readiness, really.
Yes. And that's really interesting that those reflex, they still have the reflexes up to 6 months. So really, even at 6 months, if we're looking at babies starting to sit up and all this, that's going on with along with their primitive reflexes already, isn't it?
Yes, that this is a normal progression where one skill overlaps and overrides another. The two may be present for a period of time normally, and then the higher one should gradually take over. And that's pretty much how we develop, through all our early years and later years and so on. But for some reason, in some children, something just gets blocked somewhere. And everything else develops as it should, but that specific skill can continue to be affected by the partial retention of one of those early reflexes.
Right, I see. So that would explain some of maybe some of the learning and some of the other things that are going on physically. I know that you talk a little bit about how that might affect behaviour as well. Could you tie that together for me, please?
Yes, I mean, there is one reflex, something called a symmetrical tonic neck reflex, which emerges just before a baby is ready to creep on hands and knees. And if it tries to put its head up, then the top half of the body will extend and the lower half of the body will flex.
Yeah.
If it puts its head down, the top half of the body flexes and the lower half of the body tries to extend, which, so what? But if that's still present when you go to school and you have to learn to sit up straight, provided your head is looking straight ahead, there's no problem. But if your head looks down and your arms want to collapse, it makes it very difficult to continue to sit in an upright position. It also means the upper and lower portion of the bodies are at odds with each other. They're wanting to do different things and makes it very difficult to sit still for any length of time. So these are the children who become the fidgets, the ones who wrap their legs around the chair to try and remain stable, don't want to sit still on sort of story time when sitting on the carpet, not because they're naughty, but because they can't. So behavior is the secondary outcome of an underlying physical immaturity in a specific skill.
And I'm just thinking now, I've seen children writing with their head on their arms on the table. Yes. And again, you sort of say, oh, sit up. And if they're unable to do that, you're in fact asking something to do something very difficult there, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. That's absolutely fascinating. I hadn't considered it from a physical point of view at all. That's really, really interesting. And I'm assuming that's going to lead on to things like anxiety, stress. Could you just take us a little bit about what might be the consequences of some of those things?
Well, I think you've touched on it, that if a child does not have automatic control over physical skills, they have to work at many of their tasks much harder than they should. A lot of thinking effort goes into making the body do what should have become an automatic ability.
Yeah.
And so that thinking brain gets overloaded more quickly than someone who doesn't have those difficulties.
Right, yeah.
Therefore, the threshold to stress is lower, or to starting to suffer from the effects of stress. So that can be one factor, but we also see different profile of problems in adults. We see adults who suffer from agoraphobia, acute anxiety, and panic disorder. Now, there can be many exogenous reasons as to why those can develop, but there can also be inner reasons as well. So we know that the functioning of the balance mechanism is crucial to our sense not only of physical stability, but emotional stability as well.
Yeah.
And that many of the physical symptoms associated with experience of anxiety can be induced by inappropriate or overstimulation of the balance mechanism and its related sensory systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you go on a roller coaster, it's fine if you enjoy it, you get a real buzz from it. But if you don't, you feel sick, you feel disorientated, you feel distressed. And so the margin between being someone who enjoys it and who doesn't like it is actually quite subtle and quite small.
Yeah.
So some of our adults are those who are the children with physical immaturities grown up. Their problems were not so severe that they were picked up as learning difficulty children when they were younger. Mm-hmm. They've got through the education system by working hard, by being good students. And as the pressures build up later on, then they start to suffer from emotional stress. If they don't identify a physical cause for that stress can become generalized, and you can start to develop avoidance behaviors, of which agoraphobia would be one example, also recognizing there can be many other reasons for the development of agoraphobia. But often, simply by carrying out an assessment on an adult and inducing the feelings associated with stress during part of the assessment, you can help them for 50% of the way of being able to deal with it, because they say, oh, now I understand. If you've been able to make me feel like that simply by this simple test, it shows that there is a reason for it, instead of it being something which is they are not in control of, because they don't know what sets it off.
Yeah. And sometimes having that explanation, well, you need that explanation before you can start to move forward, don't you? You need to understand what is happening already.
Yes.
Well, so as you say, if that's been undiagnosed in childhood with younger children, then that can manifest to all sorts of things as an adult. So what we need to do then is just take it right back. How can we spot this? How can we assess what's going on with children rather than, oh, that's something else? How can we assess what's happening?
Well, I think that's my political soapbox until I retire, or I go into my own little box, I think. Way back in the 1980s, when my eldest son first went to school, a school medical officer used to see all children for a preschool test, where they would ask them to stand on one leg, hop to one end of the room, pile some bricks, simple vision and hearing test.
Yeah.
Those were then phased out. So by the time my second son went to school, which was only 2 years later, they were no longer done. Now, they were phased out because it was said, well, if we identified problems at that time, we didn't necessarily have effective programs of intervention. So rather than simply assessing for assessment's sake, those assessments were discarded. But in actual fact, they are incredibly useful. And we have produced a simple screening test for teachers, clinicians, health practitioners to use. It's not a diagnostic test, but it is a screening procedure which you can use with children from about 4.5, 5 years of age and upwards to identify, are there indications of physical immaturity still present in this child before they start school? And that can be used again throughout their school career as a way of identifying children who not will have later difficulties, but are at risk of having difficulties as a result of those little physical immaturities being present. And the ideal to me would then be to make a referral to the appropriate agency or professional to then investigate it further or implement physical programs in school. So it's not actually rocket science to try and reduce the incidence of this and help a larger number of children to achieve and teachers to be effective in the job that they're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really good point, isn't it? If you're asking children to do something physically they're unable to do, then nobody wins, do they? The teachers don't get good outcomes, the children don't get good outcomes. And you can use that screening from preschool. So that is age, in the UK, that's age 4 and 5, is that right?
And upwards, and then you can use a slightly different battery of tests at 7 years of age, 9 years of age, 11, 13. Ideally, there should be no child going through the system who is not picked up at the earliest possible stage to say, right, this child doesn't have any problems with intelligence or ability to learn, but there is a blockage or there is a barrier to their ability to show that. And we should be able to do, not in all cases, but in many cases, do something about it.
Yeah, so that screening isn't only identifying that there is something, you're also identifying what that something is, and then you can set them presumably down a path of some sort, to start to correct some of those things.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm going to guess here that because every child develops differently, that that program is going to be different for every single child, and that will be unique. It's not just a one size fits all.
Yes and no. I mean, it's always a problem of money, isn't it? In every system, every service. So the individual program we have developed over many years is still only accessed through the private system. And it was in answer to that that way back in 1996, I put together a developmental movement program that could be used with an entire class of children in school on the basis of either a one-day teaching course for teachers, although that's now also been published, so people can access it through the publication as well. And the idea is that all children in the class can go through the program. It is aimed at those that need it most. But what has surprised even us is that those children who didn't apparently need it at the outset seem to gain some benefits in other skills, such as playground, coordination, PE, ability to sit still for longer, just general physical readiness to be able to cope with the demands of the world in which they're going to live.
How interesting that is that you can do that with a whole group of children, and as you say, everybody benefits there. There are no losers. You've gone right from the other end, to a win-win all round, haven't you?
Well, we hope so. I mean, there is always need for ongoing research and ongoing re-evaluation. So the studies that we did are now a few years old. But there was one of particular interest in Derbyshire schools where they took one entire year group of children, aged 7 to 8, I think they were, 90 children. All children were assessed on the physical test to begin with and educational measures. They put one class of children through the school-based IMPP programme, one class through general movements for the same time period each day, and the third class did only what was part of the national curriculum physical education. And they reassessed them on physical tests and educational measures at the end. And what they found was that the children who did an extra 10 minutes of daily exercise of any kind made twice as much improvement as the children who did no extra exercise, which is interesting. But they made only half as much as the children who did specific developmental movements that were aimed at trying to put these underlying problems right. So you know, it's an old piece of research. It wasn't a very large set of numbers, but it was interesting in that it suggests that daily physical movement of any kind is valuable.
Yeah.
But targeting it more specifically at the needs of the group that you're using is likely to be more effective. And I would like to see sort of ongoing research really following up on that with larger numbers.
And that's amazing. I mean, you're not talking about having to send them away, or that's just something that any school could tap into that could put in place. Obviously, there's going to be some training of teachers and you'll need to know how to do the course. But you're not talking about rocket science here, are you? It's very easily applied.
You're accessing a large number of children, or providing something for a large number of children for very little cost, really, once you start to use it as a class-based program.
Yeah.
There will always be children within that group who ideally should have something devised more specifically for them.
Yes.
But it's a great deal better than nothing, and perhaps not as perfect as it could be.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic place to start, isn't it? So what sort of activities would you advise would be particularly beneficial for children? What type of things are you talking about?
It depends on the age of the children that you're targeting. Movements that involve stimulation and practice of balance are generally incredibly useful, because it is often, balance I often describe as the forgotten sense. Yeah. You know, we talk about vision and hearing and touch and taste and smell and so on. But in actual fact, with the exception of taste and smell, every one of those other sensory systems actually has to work in cooperation with the balance mechanism to give us stable perception. So if there is an underlying problem in the functioning of balance, it will speak through difficulties in processing information in other sensory systems. So by working with balance, you work at the core or the foundation level. So it's movement, making sure children have plenty of movement opportunities throughout the day, and that those movement opportunities start from their level of ability rather than higher than their level of ability, so that they are succeeding and building upwards rather than trying to drag a child up from the top down.
Yeah.
I know that's sort of very general description, but it's difficult to give you specifics. I can tell you what our movement programs are based on. They take children back in time developmentally to replicate movements they should have made and mastered when they were very much younger, long before they started school. Theory being that you can put that vocabulary back in, but again, starting from the bottom upwards, building from the roots up towards the top rather than from the branches down.
So that's, are you talking as basic as crawling? Or you take it right back?
Pre-crawling. The school program takes 9 months of daily exercises to get the children ready to crawling and creeping at the end of the program. That's one of the major differences between our program and perhaps many other well-known motor training programs, that they will start at perhaps the crawling and creeping cross-pattern movement stage of development.
Yeah.
And we say, yes, that's fine, and it will work for many, many children. But there are others who actually, this has never become an integrated function, and you need to put earlier pieces of motor vocabulary in place first to enable those then to become an automatic and integrated skill later on.
Wow, yes, because I think I'd read somewhere, probably in your books, that crawling is actually quite sophisticated, isn't it? Because you have to get all the movements in synchronicity. It's quite complicated,
it
really.
Babies are very clever with the things that they can do and they learn to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And the assumption is that if you put that in, then it will all come into place. And for some children, it will. It depends on their individual level of difficulty, whether they need to go earlier and whether they need to go deeper, or whether a more general motor training program will be the answer.
So, I mean, if we're thinking about practitioners who are maybe watching that are working in the baby room, who are working with some of the smallest babies, the idea that once they can walk, I think there's a temptation, oh, you can walk now, come on, stand up, stop crawling, that in fact you should be allowing them to do that maybe?
Yes, I mean, it's been suggested that the process of crawling on hands and knees trains eye movements from side to side, following one hand and then the other, at the same visual distance that a child will use for reading and writing later on, so that it is a precursor to more sophisticated eye tracking movements later.
Yeah.
And so It's the old thing of, don't try to run before you've learnt to walk, don't try and learn to walk before you've learned to crawl. I mean, not every child goes through crawling, but to embrace each of those stages as being important building blocks for later higher skills, and not to try and rush your children through those early stages.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a really, really strong message, that children should still be crawling through tunnels, should be doing all the really what we might consider basic physical things, because that's the foundation on which everything else is then built, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Are there any other activities, maybe for the preschool children, that maybe practitioners can be doing, not necessarily in preparation for school, but to aid the children in that transition?
Movement and song and movement and music together. It is often forgotten that written language developed from an oral culture in which knowledge was passed on through the telling of stories, the singing of songs, ballads, and all those sorts of things. And I often describe this as the music of language. Long before children learn to differentiate all the individual sounds within a word, they pick up the stream, the intonation, the timing, and the song, all the sort of nonverbal aspects of language. And those we learn through lullabies, nursery rhymes, listening to stories, real physical social engagement. So it's not the same when you sit in front of a screen or you play with a game, because that is pre-programmed. It doesn't listen to what the child has to say. Mm-hmm. And there's some wonderful work done by Professor Colwyn Trevathan and colleagues up at the University of Edinburgh, observing mother-infant conversations or interaction. Mm-hmm. And he shows how if a mother is talking to her baby using mother ease, and she sort of goes la da 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 da, if she waits for a few seconds, the baby will look, it will process that, and then it will give a perfect answering phrase. It'll go something like la da 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 da. If she moves on too fast, the baby can't cope with that, and it gives up. Or if somebody comes in and interrupts before the baby's had a chance to do it, it looks as if to say, well, don't you understand the good manners of social communication? You need to wait for me. So it is this, what we call paralanguage. It's gesture. Gesture precedes spoken language, just as vocalization. And these are all the things that young children need to practice and learn and experience in the early years. And so it is the games of yesteryear are still incredibly important. And it's not that I'm a Luddite and says that all technology should be eliminated, but technology is actually for us when we're older. It's not how we were designed to develop as mammals and biologically in a physical world. We still need that experience to create the building blocks for later life.
Yes, I have to say, some of my happiest memories is playing out Ring of Roses, all those lovely games that you play outside where you can really get a good level of movement as well as all the language that's built in with that. I think that's really nice. So that's really simple again, isn't it? That's circle games outside, that's games indoors that have got a physical element to them. Doesn't cost anything, you just need to maybe think about what you're presenting for the children, what you're giving to them there. That's really great advice, thank you very much. What if we do have practitioners out there who maybe have concerns about their children that are thinking, I think there's something that's not gelling quite right here. What would you suggest that they do?
Again, it depends a little bit on the age of the child and the type of problems they're concerned about. We developed many years ago a screening questionnaire. Once again, it is only a screening device, not a diagnostic tool. But that has been published several times in various books and articles. Practitioners can access that through contact with us or our website. And it gives them an indication, are there enough factors in early development to suggest that neuromotor immaturity may be one factor in this child's presenting problems? Mm-hmm. It also has an auditory section to see whether auditory processing difficulties may be a contributing factor. It also has a very simple indications for signs of sort of biochemical nutritional factors that may be playing a part in perhaps a child's behavioural problems. So that's something that they can access. They can use it together with the parents, see whether it's flagging up concerns, and then on the basis of how highly a child has scored, it will give them an indication as to which direction they might suggest that parent follows.
That's really interesting because that's a whole suite of things, isn't it? It's a whole range of things, and it just highlights how children develop holistically, but also that sometimes it's not as simple as we think it might be at the beginning. But that's really, really interesting. I know that you do training for practitioners and for teachers and for parents as well. Could you tell us a little bit about the sorts of training courses that you do, please?
We have three levels. We have a screening, a one-day course for clinicians and health practitioners in screening for signs of this, some of whom will then want to go on and learn how to do it. For many others, all they need to know is how to identify it and then to pass on either within the medical service or other agencies where the family can get extra help. We then have a one-day course for teachers in the use of the screening tests they can use in school and how to implement the class-based program that we've talked about. And then we have a one-year course for professionals who need to have an existing qualification in either education, medicine, psychology, or an allied field to access that course, but in how to learn how to become practitioners who will do the assessments and supervise individual programs with children.
Well, so that is as deep as you'd like to go, isn't it? If you did a whole year course, you could then roll that out. I think that'd be fascinating for teachers as well to come along and learn how you can implement this in your setting. Of course, that's lifelong then, isn't it? Once you've got those good habits, I think that would be
Yes, and
excellent.
once the school has got it within the system, then that can be rolled out year upon year with ideally it's year three group are the best age to do it with, but it can be done with other age groups. But that school then has it as a tool in place which can become part and parcel of their ethos, really.
I just think that would be absolutely excellent. That's would be a massively worthwhile investment, I think that. Sally, it's been absolutely fascinating talking with you, all about the work that you do and some of the really quite simple things that we can implement, but also the change in the way that we think about how children learn and how they behave, and unpicking that a little bit. That's been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Early Years Web Summit, Sally Goddard-Blythe.
Thank you.
And thank you to our viewers and listeners for joining us today on the Early Years Web Summit, focusing on children's personal, social, emotional development.